We're spending a long time, not sure how long, but very long, looking at the Gospel of Luke, and we're continuing that. We recognize that Jesus is the most profound and most important person in the universe, and that his life has so much to learn. We have so much to learn from his life and his teaching. Luke is 50% of Luke is the words of Jesus. So if you want to know what Jesus said, Luke is a great source. And today we are looking at what Jesus said about anxiety. Try not to worry. What Jesus said about anxiety. We looked at fear a few weeks ago, but anxiety is slightly different. One definition of anxiety, it's a future-orientated mood in which one attempts to cope with possible negative events. It's a future-orientated mood. Fear is different because fear is usually short-lived. It's focused on the present. It's focused on a threat that's very much there. This person is going to reject me. This thing has happened to me. That lion might eat me. You know, fear is very much focused in the present, whereas anxiety is much more focused on the future. You know, I might not be able to pay the mortgage. I might die. My wife might leave me. My kids might not get jobs. They might not leave home. They might hog the TV forever. The anxiety is focused on future possible events that may or may not happen. There's many different effects of anxiety, actually. Let me read some of them to you. Heart palpitations, muscle weakness, tension, fatigue, nausea, chest pain, shortness of breath, stomach aches, headaches. The body basically prepares to deal with a threat and then stays in a state that it's not meant to stay in. Some external signs are pale skin, sweating, trembling, pupils dilated. Turn and look at the pupils of the person next to you. Just have a quick check that they're not too dilated. Some of you are worried already. Don't worry about the pupils of the person next to you. That's not going to help. But actually, we can joke about it, but this sense of anxiety affects all of us. For some, it can be devastating. Panic attacks hit some people literally out of nowhere. And the fears often irrational, but are very, very real to the person who's experiencing those. There's emotional and mental effects, apprehension, trouble concentrating, feeling tense or jumpy, anticipating the worst, irritability, difficulty getting on with people. Karen was listing off some of the effects that she's had in her life. It is massively detrimental to our health. It affects our behavior. Sleeplessness is a big issue. The inability to make a decision, just crying for no reason. These can be signs of anxiety. Nail biting, and my favorite, foot tapping or leg jumping. Which I do, but I don't think it's anxiety. And we're in the cinema, and Karen's like, "Stop it! You're jumping the whole row." I'm just adding my own special effect. I don't think it works great in earthquake movies. timed perfectly. It causes us to eat too much, and of course, shopping can come actually as people try and cope with anxiety. And then they get the credit card bill. And then they think, I'm going to eat, it's cheaper. There's all sorts of symptoms. And I don't know if there's anyone here who would not be impacted or affected in some way by anxiety or the effects of it. And you know what? The thing is, we have to get free from this. We have to get free from this. For our sakes, of course, but also because, I don't know if you've noticed, but the world is being shaken. Things that people trust in are being shaken. Governments, currencies, whole continents are being shaken in a way that perhaps they have never been shaken before. Things that people use to placate their anxiety are being shaken. It's like there is literally a spiritual earthquake going on across the planet. And what is going to happen when that happens is that the world is going to start to look for some other solution. And if they see a church that is just as anxious, just as uptight, just as fearful as they themselves are, they're going to look elsewhere. But if they see a church that even in the most difficult and extreme circumstances is filled with peace and joy, they are going to come running. They are going to come running. It is so critical that we get free on this issue. what will they find when there are redundancies in your workplace? And the guys and the girls are talking at lunch hour. Are they going to find someone who looks and smells different? In a good way. What are they going to find when there's a health scare and you're sitting in the hospital waiting room with a whole lot of other people who are facing health scares? Are they going to see someone who looks different? What are your mates going to find when you're in the pub and watching the news and one depressing story after another comes on? What's the conversation going to be like? Will we be salt and light, or we just blend in with the rest of the anxiety that's going on? This is such a live issue today. Nevermore. I love the fact that Jesus' words 2,000 years ago are alive today and relevant. Let's read it in Luke 12, 22. Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, nor about your body, what you will put on. For life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouses nor barns, and yet God feeds them. How much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? If you then are not able to do this small thing..." This should be on the screen, actually. Can you just check that? There's a whole PowerPoint that maybe you haven't got, obviously. I'll keep reading. "If you then are not able to do this small thing..." Where am I? "If you're not then able to do this small thing, why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? Do not seek what you are to eat or what you are to drink, nor be worried, for the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give to the needy, provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." There's some things that we can draw from Jesus' words here that are so profound and so important. Firstly, there are things he says that we might have anxiety about. He says you might be anxious about your life. You might be anxious about clothing. Is Jesus saying don't bother eating? No, I mean, eating's a good thing. Is he saying don't bother wearing clothing? I'm so pleased that you came dressed this morning. There's actually a little public speaking tip that says if you're feeling fearful, what you should do is you should imagine that the entire audience is naked. I never do that. I find that very, very disturbing. And if you go around imagining other people naked, that's a whole nother sermon right there, which I don't have time to go into this morning. But I'm no psychiatrist, but you want to get someone to look at that. That's not healthy, okay? Clothing is a good thing, but what Jesus is trying to do here is he's saying, if I can tap in the basic sources of anxiety, food and clothing. He was obviously talking to a culture that actually lived very hand to mouth. Food and clothing was a very live issue. Interestingly, I mean, even 10 years ago in the UK, how many people worried about what they would eat or what they would wear or paying the mortgage? Actually, quite a small percentage compared to today anyway. Where actually there probably isn't a household that isn't at least talking about the cost of living, the cost of energy, the cost of paying the mortgage. Actually, these words are very live for today. You see, Jesus is saying that here that there are things from the most basic level to the most complex level that we can be anxious about. Mark Driscoll's American pastor, he says it boils down to three issues. It's not getting what we want. Our hope is hung on something. I want a job. I want to serve God. I want to own a house. I want to eat. I want to heat my house. It's not getting what we want. That's the fear. The anxiety comes in. Or it's getting what we want, but then losing it. You know, that's why so many in the West are more anxious than those that actually materially have much less. because we have so much, and then the anxiety switches not from not getting what I want, but having what I want, but losing what I wanted. You know, I want to get married. I am married. What if I get divorced? We want to have a child. We are pregnant. What if the baby doesn't make it? What if I lose my house or my job, etc., etc.? And thirdly, it's getting what you don't want. Anxiety centers around getting the things you want, losing the things you've already got, or getting things you don't want. I didn't want to be sick. I didn't want to lose my job. It's not what I wanted. And Jesus is saying there are so many things that we can be anxious about. But in this passage, he's going right at the heart of the basic needs of humanity because of this reason. If he can solve our anxieties on these two things, then the principles apply to everything else. If we can get over anxieties on this base level, the principles apply to everything else. The second thing is this. Why should we not let anxiety dominate us? Verse 25, he says this. Which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? If then you are not able to do this small thing, why are you anxious about the rest? Some of you have heard my story when I was found by my mum crying. I'm not going to be able to do my O-levels, my GCSEs for old people. I'm not going to be able to do my O-levels. I'm not going to be able to do my O-levels, crying. How do you know you're not going to be able to do them? I've looked at the exam papers. I can't even understand the questions. Crying, weeping over this. Settle down, Simon. You're only 6 years old. You're only 6 years old. I've been looking at my brother's exam papers. And there was a survey taken. It explains so much about me, doesn't it? Some people are like, oh, I just got a whole new box for you. There was a survey taken that says this. People's anxieties, percentage-wise, are grouped like this. People are anxious about 40% of the time, they're anxious about things that will never happen. 30% of the time, they're anxious about things that relate to the past that can't be changed anyway. 12% of the time, they're anxious about things relating to other people's criticism, a lot of which isn't even true. 10% of the time, they're anxious about things relating to health. And the thing is, health typically gets worse when you're anxious. Only 8% of the time do they worry about real concerns that actually will be faced. This is the reality. 92% of our worry actually achieves nothing. 92% of our worry. I heard a story of a guy who decided to do all his worrying just on one day a week. He was a real worrier, and he picked Wednesdays. Because you can't pick Mondays, because that's hard enough anyway. And Fridays, you want to get ready for the weekend. So he thought Wednesdays is a good day for worrying. So he decided, I'm going to do all my worrying on Wednesday. And what I'm going to do is, on any other day, I'm going to write on Wednesday. I'm going to write all my worries down. I'm going to put them in a box. And on Wednesday, I'll write them all down, put them in the box, and I will not think about anything, any worries for the rest of the week. And then the next week, I'll look at it. Do you know what he found? The next week when he looked in his... Some of you are thinking, this is a great idea. I think it actually is. I might try it. But what he found was the next week, on the following Wednesday, he went through all the things he'd written down on the previous Wednesday. And the vast majority of them were things that no longer concerned him whatsoever. And he would have wasted the whole week worrying about stuff that was not relevant. You see, the lie that we believe is this. If I worry, it will help me. We believe that worrying has power. The truth is this. Worry has no power. It changes nothing. That's what Jesus is saying here. It doesn't even have the power to add a single hour to your life. Worry has no power. Turn to your neighbor and say that. Worry has no power. Worry has no power. It has no power. And this is what Jesus is saying. He's saying it uses up resources. It uses up resources on the inside that achieve nothing and are then wasted for 92% at least of the occasion. Someone once said, worry is like a rocking chair. It gives you something to do, but it actually gets you nowhere. Isn't that so true? Next time you're worrying, think about yourself in a rocking chair. This is giving me something to do, but it gets me nowhere. Some of you might say, well, I worried about something once, and it actually did come true. Simon, you're wrong. Because the 8%, what about the 8%? I worried about something once and it actually did come true. Well, I guess the question is, even if it does come true, did your worrying help you? Did it actually prepare you more for that eventuality? Or did it just extend the pain of the eventuality over a much longer period? You see, if only we could believe the truth, and I count myself in this, because I don't believe there's anyone exempt from this. If only we could believe the truth of Jesus' words, worry has no power. It would change us dramatically from the inside out. Because we would stop fueling a fire that's going nowhere, and instead, all that fuel that we have, we would put somewhere else. And that's where this gets to, really. This is what Jesus is driving at. How do we live an anxiety-free life? What you tolerate will dominate. We've tolerated worrying so long, it has dominated. Have we got to the point where we're saying, Jesus, help me? Have you got to that point where you're saying, Jesus, help me? Help me. Jesus, help me. Have you got to that point? Do I start again at the beginning? You're like, no. Do I start again at the beginning? Or have we got to the point where we're like, Jesus, you've got to help us get free on this issue. You've got to help us live a worry. Is it even possible to live a worry-free life? There's got to be that holy desperation that says, I'm not prepared to tolerate this any longer. I don't want to live like this. Jesus, help me. Help me get to that point where I can live a worry-free life. When we get to that point, we are ready to hear what Jesus has to say. And he says five things, which we'll do very quickly. He's not saying, as Karen made the point, that these keys will stop us ever having the potential to be anxious. What he's saying is, these things are key that when anxiety comes, you leave it on the outside of the door of your heart. These are the keys that win the battle of anxiety. Things that cause us anxiety will always come. Perceived, unperceived, real or imaginary, they will always come. It's what we do with them when they come that makes the difference. And this passage gives us five things. Firstly, it's your choice. He says to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious. Do not be anxious. What is he saying? You have a choice. With the command comes the promise of freedom. You actually do have a choice. That's what Karen's testimony so powerfully told us, wasn't it? You have a choice when it comes to worry and anxiety. You have a choice. But no, I've always been a worrier. You have a choice. But my mother was a worrier. You have a choice. But, you know, I bite my nails and I've even tried that paint that makes it taste disgusting and that doesn't work. You have a choice. I have a choice when it comes to worry. Anxiety, like biting the nails until they bleed. Anxiety is like biting your soul until it bleeds. But the reality is, just like biting your nails, you have a choice. We have a choice. We have a choice. If you've been locked up, like Karen, for decades with anxiety, even on whatever level, huge, small, the reality is that Jesus says you've got a choice. And the next thing he says is this. It's your choice and it's your identity. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They've got neither storehouses or barns, and yet God feeds them. How much more value are you than the birds? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? What's his point? Ravens are nasty birds. I mean, they really are scavengers. They are scavengers. They were kind of like the lowest on the in these Jesus' day on the bird hierarchy. They were the scavengers. They scavenge off corpses and dead animals. That's what ravens were. What's Jesus' point? If God cares for the ravens, the ones at the bottom of the food chain, how much more does he care for you? How much more does he care for you? How much more does he care for one of his kids if he cares for a raven? And look at the lilies. You know, they don't get up in the morning and say, you know, does my bum look big in this petal? I don't think, you know, I'm a spring. You know, springs shouldn't wear white or green, especially not together. And yet he says they are beautiful. They are beautiful. God dresses his kids if he dresses the lilies. He's saying, have faith. Have faith in what? Have faith that your heavenly Father thinks you're valuable. That he thinks you're valuable. Have faith that your heavenly Father thinks you're valuable. John Egan was a school teacher who was not famous in his lifetime, but after he died was famous because of his journal. Because his journal was a spiritual pathway to encountering God. And one of the breakthroughs for John came when he was talking to his spiritual mentor, and he was on an 8-day retreat, which he took once a year, just to get time away from the hustle and bustle of life. And he took this retreat, and the spiritual mentor said this one phrase to him, which changed his life. And he said, John, the secret of everything is this: define yourself as one radically loved by God. Define yourself as one radically loved by God. It's the only place that is, it's the only truth that is acceptable as a center for your being. Define yourself. You see, the world would define yourself by your success, your house, your marriage, your family, your kids, your degrees, your education. I used to have a friend, he was paranoid. Every situation he would go into, he would assess the education levels of everyone around him. It took a long time to work out what they were because he was defining himself by education. And yet, the truth is, we define ourselves by the value that we have in God's eyes. It changes everything. It changes everything. It's your choice. It's your identity. It's your Father. Your Father knows that you need them. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. If you're not a Christian here today, you need to know that this is not a self-help guide. Jesus, his reality, his teaching was based on the fact that you can only get free from anxiety or any other issue when you encounter the Father. And if you're not a Christian here this morning, you need to know that that offer is available. If you like what you see in the people around you, you need to know that you too can have the same thing. That no matter what you've done, where you've come from, who you are, you can encounter this Father and it changes everything. When you know that you have a Father who loves you and who is out for you and is designing and planning a universe, even the mess, even the darkness, for your good. It changes everything. That's what's available. This is not a self-help guide, but if you're a Christian, then recognize that our freedom from anxiety starts with the knowledge of the goodness of the Father. That no matter what comes against you, no matter what issue you face, and God never promised that we wouldn't face difficult issues, but no matter what comes against you, the root out of it is the knowledge of the goodness of the Father. That he is so good. I mean, just examine Jesus' words. Follow his logic. Fear not, little flock. It's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Little flock. It's a term of affection, isn't it? It's an expression of that you are under God's affection. That you are under the Father's affection. He sees you as something little, as something precious, as something fragile. He sees you in that way. It's his good pleasure. He is not a reluctant giver. He is not holding out. It's his joyful, it's his good pleasure to give you, not swap it, not exchange it for your hard work for the rest of your life, to give you the kingdom. Fear not, little flock. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And I was talking with Matt Cook once, and we were both agreeing that one of the most powerful illustrations that we'd ever seen came from this reality. Because in 1 Peter 5, it says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he might exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you. And we had many years ago a guy called David Devenish come to speak, who's one of the leaders in New Frontiers group of churches. And Matt and I were talking, come, Matt, come and help me. And he got a ball, a large ball like this. And he says, this is the reality. You ready for this, Matt? It's a little bit bigger than the one he used, actually. But anyway, we'll try. So he got this. Said, this is the reality. He says, while your hands are filled with your anxieties, God can give you so little. Cast your anxieties onto him. Please don't work, actually, mate. Are you? It's relief. Because he cares. And the thing is, we want to go and wrestle this stuff back from God and take it back. And sometimes we do, and sometimes we take it back from God. But the truth is, again and again, we need to cast our anxieties on him. And we need to leave them with him. Thank you very much, Matt. That was, it's profound to relive that moment, wasn't it, actually? One of the most powerful illustrations of the Christian life. One person said, when I go to bed at night, I give all of my problems to God. Because he's going to be up all night anyway. He's going to be up all night anyway. There's a powerful truth in this. I remember one time I was in the day, suddenly I got this massive pain in my side. Huge, great pain in my side. And the thought came to me, it just came out of nowhere. And the thought immediately came to me, you've got cancer. And it just began to build through the day. This thought, the pain got worse and worse and worse. And this thought began to build during the day. You've got cancer and God is already preparing somebody else to lead the King's Arms. And it's already, the plan has already been in place and it's already happening. You need to get ready to hand this thing over and move on. And it just got literally, I was like under this cloud. It just got darker and darker and darker and darker. And my thoughts were spiraling round and round and round and round. And in the end, I cried out, God, you've got to help me. Because I knew that other thoughts would come, which was, oh, it's not probably not true. But I knew this could be true. I said, God, there's no one else who can speak into this but you. There's no other encouraging word that anyone can say but you. Because it's only you that can speak into this. And I cried that out, and then I fell asleep. And then I woke up, as it were, with a start. And I heard the Father's voice. And he said this, Simon, I'll tell you when it's your turn to die. And just the peace of God just flooded my heart. The strange thing was, he didn't actually say, it's not your time to die now. He just said, I'll tell you. You see, we've got to live with the reality that he is a good father. And that Jesus never promised that we would not suffer. But he said, I'll be with you right the way through. I will be with you. And so many Christians fall at this hurdle. They come into faith thinking that if I become a Christian, everything will get fixed. And they have a cruise ship mentality. I got saved. I'm on a cruise ship. Get out the deck chairs. Get a suntan. And then what happens? A bomb drops in the swimming pool. And they're like, no, my cruise ship is ruined. And they go and hammer on the captain's door. Excuse me, a bomb just dropped in the swimming pool. My tan is ruined. And they fall away. They fall away. I've been saved into a warship. We have been saved into a warship, which means that when a bomb drops in the swimming pool, firstly, we're grateful that we actually had a swimming pool because most warships don't have swimming pools. So that we're grateful that we actually even had a swimming pool in the first place. And what do? Instead of being surprised, instead of complaining to the captain, what do? We pick up our weapons and start shooting. What's the mentality? What have you been saved into? If you think you've been saved onto a cruise ship, you will not last in this Christian life. But if you realize, no, I've been saved into a warship. This is a war, but he is a good father. And I don't sometimes understand why he takes us into such treacherous waters, but he is so good. And he promises that he will be with me and all things will work for good and for his glory. Fourthly, your direction. Do not seek what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink, nor be worried, for all the nations of the world seek these things. Your Father knows you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom and all these things will be added to you. What are you seeking? What am I seeking? Provide for your family, career fulfillment, holiday, retirement. There's nothing wrong with any of these things. But Jesus is saying this, when they are in number one place, something goes badly, badly wrong. Because number one place has only got room for one thing. It's either God or it's something else. And as soon as something else gets on that throne, as soon as your primary direction becomes that thing, career advancement, what happens when your career goes off? Your whole world gets shaken. There's nothing wrong with career advancement. There's nothing wrong with providing for the family. These are important things. But Jesus is like, they are not number one things. Number one things are God and his kingdom. And when you seek that, everything else just slots into place. When you keep the main thing, the main thing. I remember one time I was praying and God said to me, I want you to volunteer for the church one day a week. And immediately fear gripped my heart. How are we going to provide? How are we going to make ends meet? Etc., etc. But Caroline and I prayed it through, and I thought, well, a natural thing will be I'll talk to work, and they'll probably say no. Now, my boss at the time loved me. He thought I was fantastic. I know some of you struggle. But he thought I was amazing. And he was going to be promoted to the head of the whole group. It was inevitable, and he had already said that he wanted to take me with him to oversee all the IT for the group. And so I went, I thought, he's going to say no, there's no way you can go to part-time, because I already had like 6 days work to do in 5 days, there's no way. And so I went to his office and sat down, and I could tell by the look on his face, he was absolutely gutted. But he was such a great man, and he said, Simon, I will support you in what you want to do, but you need to know, this is career suicide. This is career suicide. And I walked out of that office, and I talked with Caroline, and we thought, okay, here we go. Boom. Career suicide. Why? Because I knew that even if I had the greatest career, it was never going to be in number one place. If that's what it took to obey God, that's what it took. And the amazing thing was that year, that following year, we earned more, strangely, on 4 days a week than we did the previous year on 5 days through various gifts and other things. When we did the financial accounts, it was amazing. Hasn't happened since, but that next year was amazing. Because it's out of that place, isn't it, of saying, God, whatever will be, when number one is number one and is the right thing. And lastly, it's your gift. Radical generosity. Jesus is not talking, of course, to people who can't be bothered to provide for their families, just as a caveat. He's not talking to people who are too lazy to provide for their families, who are too lazy to work. He's not talking to lazy people. He's talking to worried people. He's got a whole other sermon for lazy people. This is to worried people. But lastly, it's your gift. Radical generosity. Sell your possessions, give to the needy, provide yourself with money bags that do not grow old, and with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches, no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You know, sometimes I go with my kids to the Christmas fair, and to be honest, I couldn't care less about the stalls. I couldn't care less about the giant fluffy pandas. They bother me not. Until you put a pound on number 43. And then suddenly, number 43 and that giant fluffy panda becomes the most important thing in your zone. Anyone else relate to this? You put money on this, and suddenly this thing becomes the most important thing. And of course, the greater the money, the greater the pull. That's why so many on the stock market committed suicide when it crashed, because they had so much invested. What's Jesus saying? He's saying this. We think, put your heart there and your money will follow. No, no, no. He's very, very practical. Put your money there, your heart will follow. What you are invested in, your heart will follow. What you are invested in, your heart will follow. This is very, very practical. Why radical generosity is at the heart of getting free from anxiety. Another side reason is this. So many of our anxieties are tied up with our possessions that when we give our possessions, what happens? Your anxieties go with them. Your anxieties go with them. They lose their hold on your life. They lose their hold on my life. I love this quote, and I'll finish with this. We need to pray. E. Stanley, who was a missionary to India, wrote this. I am inwardly fashioned for faith, not fear. Fear is not my native land. Faith is. I am so made that worry and anxiety are sand in the machinery of life. faith is the oil. I live better by faith and confidence than by fear, doubt, and anxiety. In anxiety and worry, my being is gasping for breath. These are not my native air, but in faith and confidence I breathe freely. These are my native air. A Johns Hopkins University doctor says, we do not know why it is that worriers die sooner than non-worriers, but that is a fact. But I, who am simple of mind, think I know. We are inwardly constructed in nerve and tissue, brain cell and soul, for faith and not fear. God made us that way. To live by worry is to live against reality. I wish I could write quotes like that sometimes, but at least I can read them. To live by worry is to live against reality. I pray for my own life, for your life, that the Church of Jesus Christ rises up in the worry and the anxiety of today to live by a different mold, to live by a different way, that we would shine like the light as the world is shaken in your workplace, in your school, in your university, in your home, that you would shine like the light as people say to you, how are you living with so much peace? How are you living with so much joy? And then you can tell them how. It's not a self-help guide. It's a person. His name is Jesus Christ. And he changes everything.